Welcome to another discussion on science and the Bible, brought to you by Wellspring Christian Family Schools. This is Jay Oxt of the Institute for Scientific and Biblical Research. Today's topic will be fossils, a fascinating topic. It's also a huge topic that is very difficult to really dwell on in an audio presentation. What we really need is to be able to show you hundreds or thousands of great illustrations and pictures and whatnot of these fossils. So what we will do today, we will briefly discuss six aspects of such an enormous topic. What are those six topics? Well, first one will be, what is a fossil? Sounds simple, but let's describe that. Topic number two, the formation. How are they formed? Topic number three, fossil demographics. In other words, how many of what types of fossils do we have? Point four, we'll talk about the Cambrian period, which is kind of a fossil explosion. That's at the beginning, you know, the deepest rock formations, the earliest good fossils that we are talking about all the time. And then we will jump up towards point number five, the human fossils. So we'll discuss the beginning of the fossil record, and we'll discuss the end of the fossil record in this presentation. Then lastly, point number six, just a couple of interesting, which I find to be exciting, recent findings in the fossil record. So, point number one, what is a fossil? Well, for the most part, it's a rock. Now, there are exceptions, of course. There's cases where someone has lost, say, a bronze bell that became embedded in solidified sediment, which became sedimentary rock. And, it was still bronze. Okay, but when we're talking about living things that form fossils, these fossils are generally rock. If it was buried not very long ago, it may still have some carbon material in it. Now, what's the difference? Well, over a period of time, and it depends on what type of material that it was buried in, the minerals in the animal or whatever it is that was buried, those minerals are displaced by the minerals of the sediment in the sedimentary rock. Okay, so this leaves an impression in the rock. It's a rock impression that could be as simple as just say, like footsteps, or even as small as raindrops, or it could be have the exact same structure and shape as what it was that got buried. In the United States, the largest formation of fossils is called the Morrison Formation, which is 700,000 square miles, and it is full of fossils. The Morrison Formation extends from southern New Mexico all the way up into the little bit of Canada, all right? Montana, Wyoming, and Colorado, the entire states, for all practical purposes, are in the Morrison Formation. Well, so how are fossils formed? We kept using that word, formation. How are fossils formed? Well, if you think about critters that die, what happens? You don't want to think about that very long, do you? Because it stinks. Well, typically they decay. They're attacked by scavengers and the bacteria and whatever eats it up. It completely decays. It doesn't form fossils. So how is a fossil formed? Well, it has to die. Obviously, well, it has to, it may not even be in that order, but it needs to be buried rapidly in sediment. It may be killed by that burial as well. It could be buried alive. but in any event, it needs to be buried rapidly and completely in a sediment. And one of the fascinating things about fossils is that when you look at the fossil record, you see this rapid burial all over the place. For example, we have fossils of a fish eating its lunch, eating another critter. We have fossils of, say, a flying creature with a fish, all in the same fossil. There's one particular one of a Cynosauropteryx, which is a flying lizard, and a fish. How can a flying creature and a fish be buried together? Well, think about that for a minute. We also have a fossil of an ichthyosaur giving birth to a baby ichthyosaur. That's rapid fossilization. We also have a fossil of a small mammal about the size of a small dog with he's surrounded by fish. How did this mammal get fossilized, buried with all these fish? Can you think of a specific event that would bury all these different types of creatures all together? Sounds like that might be related to Noah's flood. In fact, in our third radio program, we talked about the geology. Originally, the evolutionary idea was that all of these sediments were laid down one grain at a time. We quickly realized that, no, folks, that's not possible. If they were laid down one grain at a time over millions and billions of years, you would never have any fossils because they would completely decay before they could become fossilized. So then the next idea from the evolutionists was, okay, when you look at the sediments and the sedimentary rock in canyons and whatnot, you'll see that they look like, you know, pancakes stacked on top of each other. These are the different layers or strata. So they would teach that these different strata, each one was laid down rapidly, but there would be very long periods of time between it and the next one. So basically you have a layer laid down, eons of time, another layer laid down, eons of time, etc. However, in our third radio program, if you go to WTHUradio.com and then scroll down to Family by Design, you will see the Wellspring Christian Family Schools radio programs. And you can go back to the third one, and it will show you all of the different reasons why, no, each and every one of these layers had to have been laid down very quickly, right on top of each other. A third point will be fossil demographics. Well, what do we mean by that? Okay, when you look at all the fossils all the way around the world and just kind of count up what is what, all right, you will find out that 95% of the fossils are marine invertebrates. What do you mean by marine invertebrates? Well, these are shellfish. They lived in the ocean. And most of those are clams. So 95% of the fossils are marine invertebrates. Well, what about the other 5%, the remaining 5%? Well, the remaining 5%, of the remaining 5%, 95% of those are plants. Okay, and that includes trees and even very small fossils like of pollen and algae. Okay, plants. Well, what about the other 5%, the remaining 5%? So we have 5% of the 5%. Well, those are vertebrates, in other words, bones. So you see that there's actually very, very few bones in the fossil record. Now, interestingly enough, we mentioned the Morrison Foundation a little bit ago. Well, the Morrison Foundation is just basically, it's just filled with bones, stacks of bones, just all jumbled together, all kinds of creatures that have been ripped apart, torn apart, and they're dismembered, and they have all of these bones mixed in together. Can you think of an event that would be so violent as to literally rip creatures apart and bury them all together in one huge pile? A huge pile that runs from, you know, what do we say, New Mexico up to almost Canada. Yes, Noah's flood, one more time. Now, let's think about this, though. Now, picture the geologic column with all of the creatures and how the evolutionists have them all lined up in this million years, that million years, and all of their stages of development from one to the next to the next to the next. You have that picture? You've seen dozens of these charts. Now, keep in mind, now, let's put this together with our demographics. 5% of 5% is 0.25%. So that means that, for all practical purposes, most of this geologic column of all of these fossils was built on 0.25% of the geologic, of the fossils, rather. The whole geologic column built on 0.25% of the fossils. Wow. Okay, let's move to point number four. We'll talk about the Cambrian period. Now, I wish I could tell you it's time to go to the Smithsonian Natural History Museum, but I can't do that. In fact, I'm actually going to tell you, don't waste your time. The Smithsonian Natural History Museum has been completely revamped to, it is 120% totally evolution-based. It's like placard after placard after placard as you read it. Each individual placard kind of makes sense, but if you put them all together, it's all mumbo-jumbo and doesn't make any sense at all. The previous Smithsonian Natural History Museum, I thought was actually pretty good. Now, obviously, it was evolutionary-based, but if you'd quit gawking at all of the fossils and actually read the displays were very telling. So let's walk into the Natural History Museum, the old one, and read and look at some of these displays. As you walk into the entrance of the fossil displays, you will see a ginormous fossil that's 10 feet tall, and at the top of it, it says, "A grand opening, fossils galore," because this fossil slab is just loaded with fossils. Then you walk on in and you see like the next little placard that says, "Grand opening," again, fossils galore. So what they're trying to impress you with is that all of a sudden, all of these fossils suddenly appeared. In fact, this next one that says "Grand Opening Fossils Galore," it first talks about, you know, prior to 500 or 600 million years ago, there really weren't many fossils at all. Very small, not recognizable, really not much to study. And let me read as it finishes here. It says, "Then, suddenly, the first fossils of animals with shells or hard skeletons appear in younger rocks worldwide. This debut of familiar-looking animals in the fossil record marked the grand opening of the Paleozoic era. What followed was an astonishing increase in the variety and number of fossilized animals. Their abundance reflects an explosive evolution of new kinds of animals, animals that could be fossilized." Now, that's interesting. They're trying to imply here that it was only the hard features that could be fossilized and that soft tissue could not be. That was a myth that was spread for many, many years. I find it also Interesting that it says this is the debut of familiar-looking animals. In other words, an awful lot of them look an awful lot like animals that we have today. As we continue in this fossil, walking around in this fossil room, we'll find another placard here that says, "The curtain rises." So, once again, it's this sudden appearance. This particular placard starts off by saying, "The sudden appearance of numerous fossil groups about 600 million years ago has long intrigued scientists." It seems likely, it is doubtful that complex animals suddenly evolved from simple organisms. Okay, so remember, prior to 600 million years ago, there's hardly anything, no fossils at all. And then in the 600 to 500 million year ago, all of a sudden you have, the curtain rises, fossils galore. And so now what it's saying is, it is doubtful that complex animals suddenly evolved from simple organisms. See, that would defy evolution. As we continue reading, it says, "And it seems likely." Seems likely? Well, did it? Come on, that's not science. "And it seems likely that small, simple animals preceded larger, complex ones. Animals without shells probably came before those with shells. The evolution of hard body parts, shells, skeletons, dramatically increased an animal's chance of being preserved as a fossil. Thus, the fossil record gives the impression of sudden evolution, although the record really just turned into a program that was already in progress. We do not know how long it took animals to evolve hard parts, or why several different animal groups managed it at about the same time." You see, the conjecture after conjecture after conjecture after conjecture here. And one of the things that was taught for years and years, once again, was that the hard body parts are, could fossilize, and soft body parts would not. Okay, well, that's never been true. So this was, just ideology. It was to deceive you. As we said, as it says, the fossil record gives you the impression of sudden appearance or sudden evolution. Well, what would creation give you the impression of? It would be sudden, wouldn't it? Okay, but let's talk about this hard parts and soft parts. As we move away from this area of sudden appearance, there was a really nice presentation on trilobites. And trilobites have stumped evolutionists for years because they have fully formed eyes. So as we go into the trilobite display, we look at one of the placards there, and it says, "The eyes had it. Although the eyes of most animals are unknown as fossils, trilobite eyes are commonly preserved because the lenses are part of the mineralized exoskeleton. Trilobite eyes are the most ancient visual system known, even early in the Cambrian period. Some trilobites had fully developed compound eyes." Now, this is an interesting placard because if you think about eyes are not hard material, right? And yet, here we have eyes that have been fossilized all the way back in the Cambrian period. When is that? See, they've taken this display off to a corner someplace. That is during the fossil explosion. It's the very earliest of fossils by their definition of early. Okay, so we have the earliest fossils, and we already have fully formed functional eyes. Well, let's move to point number 7. How about human fossils? Well, in 1968, the Life Nature Library, Life magazine, had a a fold-out display of human evolution. And on this fold-out, the centerfold that folded out of the Life magazine, what you could see are 14, what they implied were fossilized creatures, in other words, 14 evolutionary stages leading up from chimpanzee to man. And they had each one of them labeled. Over the, you know, the last several millions of years of this development. That was false from the get-go, and all of the paleontologists knew it, but this particular presentation, if you can kind of think of, or this picture rather, if you can picture from the small chimpanzee-looking creature to getting straighter and straighter and taller and becoming man, that particular image went a long ways into selling the evolutionary idea. But that's not the way it works at all. If you think about Lucy, you've heard about Lucy. That's the Australopithecus. It's like a supposedly a major step between chimpanzee and man. But Lucy had a few rib bones, a few arm bones, a pelvis, half of a pelvis, part of a leg bone on one side, part of a leg bone on the other side, and fragments of a skull. Australopithecus to the rescue. We have the transition between chimpanzee and man. But do we really? One thing that they don't really like to dwell upon is that these bones for Lucy, they were not found in a single position. These were scattered bones throughout several square meters, like 50 square meters, of dirt that was all sifted out, and they basically took the various bones that looked like they could be of this particular creature, put them all together, and they come up with something that looks half chimp, half human. Well, why would it look like part chimp and part human? Because some of the bones were probably chimp, and some of the bones were probably human. So much for Lucy. As I mentioned, lining up all of these creatures is an incredibly difficult task. If we think about it, how would they even do that? Well, some of the paleontologists, they do it by looking at the shape of the skull, because the skull of a chimpanzee and the skull of a human are significantly different. Okay, and they'll talk about the jaws, talk about the shape of the skull for the brain, etc., and they line them up basic according to the shape. Then there'll be other paleontologists that say, no, that you can't do it that way. You have to look at where these fossils were retrieved in the geologic column, because obviously the deeper it is in the geologic column, the older it is, and the shallower it is, the younger that fossil is. Okay, so they would line it up by the geologic, you know, where they found it in the geology. Well, that doesn't do any good, because it contradicts the one based on the shape. Then comes DNA. They thought that the DNA, looking at different the DNA at matter that was still had DNA in it, that they could look at the DNA and find the distinct gene trail. In other words, you could see how the genes changed from one creature to the next, to the next, to the next. That should leave a history, right? Or what they refer to as a gene trail. Did they find any such gene trail? No, none at all. We should talk about that in another discussion. Then lastly, as all these people are lining things up in different manners, Some of these human fossils, as just mentioned, still had carbon in them. All right, if it had DNA, it obviously still had carbon. And in one particular case, these competitors of each other, one of them actually got some small samples of another person's fossils, sent them off for carbon-14 testing, which we talked about in a previous session. And what are they going to come up with carbon-14? Well, all of them were very, very young. Carbon-14 will always give you very young results. This particular fellow was fired because they said that he was cheating in his fossil presentations. Well, I was hoping that the paleontologists would start to get samples from each other's and all of them would be fired, but that didn't happen. Apparently, they are very protective of their samples. That would make sense. As they line them up, you'll see that they always talk that instead of having a straight line from this one to this one to this one, now the evolutionary tree just looks more like a bush with all of these skulls scattered about this bush with no connections whatsoever going from one to the next to the next. And so all of the branches, where the branches meet the trunks, those are all quote-unquote missing links. If you look at these bushes, how many missing links are there? All of them. None of them fit together. Well, lastly, I thought I'd just mention what I found to be a rather exciting find. It was very recently, just a few years ago. A few years ago, they found what they called 90-million-year-old rainforest. A 90-million-year-old rainforest. And where do you think they found that? In Antarctica. It was filled with roots and pollens of tropical type of plant life. Amazing. And then, also, at about the same time, paleontologists found fossils of frogs. Can frogs live in Antarctica? Not today, they can't. But how about prior to the flood? The environment was very, very different prior to the flood. That's one of the interesting things that I find, is that when you look at all the different sciences, maybe we should do a discussion on this alone, they all work together, whereas the evolutionary sciences are all fragmented, the creation sciences all work together. Well, we're out of time, so let's pray. Father, evolutionary dogma, especially fossils, are a major stumbling block for unbelievers and seriously cripples many believers. So, Father, I ask that everyone who listens to these presentations would be blessed and they would recognize that your word is true. Each and every word from cover to cover. Thank you, Lord Jesus. Amen.